Good morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, number 17497. I'm ADC appointed counsel for Howell Robert III. And this is a theft and fraud case involving multiple counts of check fraud. The actual facts of the underlying case are not important to the issues that I briefed in the opening brief, but I would like to point out that because this is an habitual offender case, the defendant received a sentence in excess of 200 years. So the stakes are high in this case. He will never leave the DOC if this appeal is unsuccessful. There are two issues that in the appellant's position mandate that the charges be dismissed and that he cannot be retried. And the first issue is a violation of the Uniform Mandatory Disposition of Detainers Act, and the second is state speedy trial violation. I also briefed a violation of the United States constitutional right to a speedy trial. I did that to preserve all those issues for federal review. However, I'm not going to address that issue in oral argument. I'm going to rest on my briefs on that issue. First, regarding the UMDDA, I don't think it can be disputed that Mr. Roberts was on parole. He was actually on mandatory parole when he was arrested in this new case. And the procedural history is a little unusual. He was arrested and charged. Those cases went to county court and were assigned a county court number, but they were never bound over. Instead, the district attorney dismissed them because a preliminary hearing could not be set within the mandatory time, and the defendant had demanded his UMDDA rights, so that these time limits were concrete, they're jurisdictional, and in order to get around them, the DA dismissed the charges and then took the case to the grand jury.
Does the record reflect that the charges were dismissed before the indictment was returned?
I believe they are. I believe that pursuant to the attachments to the people's opposition to the defendant's motion to dismiss, which begins at page 195, make that clear, but I could be wrong.
Would that make any difference to your argument?
It's not going to make any difference to my argument. What's critical about this is that because these charges were pending, he had counsel appointed, and then when he was brought in to answer to the new charges, the old charges hadn't been dismissed yet, but he was still represented by counsel on July 7th for these new charges, all right? And some of these charges overlap. So he was indicted for a bunch of new charges and also indicted for nine charges that he was facing before. Those charges hadn't been dismissed yet at the time he was brought in pro se on July 7th, and he questioned at length on the record as to why he was here without his counsel being present. Why that's important is then...
If you could step out of the courtroom and silence that phone, please.
Okay, I lost my train of thought here. I'm still suffering from an adrenaline overload after my harrowing ride on the turnpike this morning. I was sure I was going to end up in a ditch upside down a couple of times.
It's Colorado. We have to deal with the weather. So
what happened here on July 7th, he was pro se. He demanded on the record his UMDDA rights. Unfortunately, the record is unclear because the court reporter didn't hear him say the words, I am asserting my UMDDA rights. The record had to be reconstructed later and then made that clear. But then the next court proceeding also, he was pro se. Then ADC counsel was appointed. When he came back into court in late August of 2005, he was represented by counsel, but in the meantime, he had filed this pleading pro se, and he filed it from the Crowley County Correctional Facility. By that time, his parole had been revoked in the previous charge, so he was back in the DOC, and from the DOC, he filed this written pleading invoking the UMDDA rights. And the Attorney General claims that the title to that pleading is misleading because he didn't entitle it UMDDA demand. Instead, he entitled it something else because he was worried about all of these things. He called it notice of court, notice to court of assertion of rights and criminal procedures.
Yeah, Ms. Rodenberg, I'd like to skip a little bit into the future in your timeline and ask you about the cause for the very last continuance that ended up right before the date that the defendant was tried. And that was attributable to counsel being rescheduled by ABC in a different case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And your contention is that that's not good cause?
That was through no fault of Mr. Roberts. And first of all, that doesn't affect the UMDDA, because in order to waive the UMDDA, unlike speedy trial, the defendant has to expressly waive himself. It can't be through counsel. It can't be like he's acquiescing to a waiver because counsel does something like reschedule the trial with or without good cause. He has to personally waive that right.
So are you saying that unlike waiver, that the trial court can't extend the UMDDA deadline for good cause?
That's correct.
You are saying that?
Yeah. What I'm saying is, over the objection of the defendant, unless he is expressly waiving the UMDDA, that the court cannot extend the UMDDA deadlines for these types of situations.
Doesn't People versus Fleming say otherwise?
Well, in People versus Fleming, it was Fleming's fault that he had to have a new lawyer.
Well,
he was setting up that situation to where the court was put in that position. Mr. Roberts did not do that.
I understand that, but setting up the paradigm for the analysis, doesn't it say a lawyer can ordinarily waive a client's statutory speedy trial type rights, but where the lawyer does it over the client's objection, there must be good cause for a continuance. Isn't that the model the Supreme Court sets up?
Well, if that's what the Supreme Court said in Fleming, then the difference between Roberts and Fleming is that Fleming is the one that created the situation that caused his client to have to withdraw.
Is that the only reason? Is that the only difference between it?
Between Fleming and Roberts?
Right.
I got the impression that Mr. Fleming was intentionally doing that to set up this issue. Mr. Roberts did not do that. Every single time he was in court, he asserted his UMDDA rights and said, I am not waiving my rights. I do not agree to this. And then when his lawyer came in on skipping ahead to that date, and I forget exactly what date that was, I believe that was in June of 2006, when Mr. Hedin said, well, I've got the scheduling conflict. The ADC is trying to clear my calendar. Without more of a record, first of all, neither the DA nor the court made him make a record other than saying that. And you can kind of infer from what happened later with Mr. Hedin entering in his appearance in Robert Ray's first murder trial, that was the case he was referring to.
But that's not in the record, is it?
That
counsel?
Is not in the record.
Okay.
So all that's in the record is Mr. Hedin saying the ADC wants me to clear my calendar.
But let me ask you, in the speedy trial context, in the speedy trial statutory context, haven't our courts consistently said that a scheduling conflict would excuse or allow for an extension of the statutory speedy trial time?
Only if what the Supreme Court has held that let me get the exact language here.
I'm wondering if whether or not that type of rule would apply in the UMDDA context as well.
Well, the reason why I argued that it didn't is because of the difference between express waiver and implied waiver. In the speedy trial statute, you can have an implied waiver due to the conduct of counsel or acquiescence to accepting trial dates, or counsel can even do something over the defendant's objection. UMDDA is different. It requires express waiver. It's like waiving your right to counsel. Counsel cannot do that for the defendant.
Doesn't the Guess case seem to indicate that counsel's actions can affect, though not waive the rights, they can essentially serve to extend the period of time under which a defendant can be brought to trial under the UMDDA?
Well, what the case law says is that over the defendant's objection, you can have a reasonable period of continuance in order to reschedule counsel. What happened here was there was 3 months left on the speedy trial clock when Mr. Silver entered an appearance. Nobody made a record. The DA did not require, and I put this in my opening brief expressly, nobody required some sort of finding that Mr. Silver could not get up to speed before that speedy trial date. Instead, the court just said, no, it's automatically waived. We're within speedy trial, and he set a date beyond even what the speedy trial date would have been over the defendant's objection. And I argued in the opening brief that that violated not only speedy trial rights, but his UMDDA rights. You know, because of the complexity of these issues, and I want to reserve my last 5 minutes unless there's another question now.
Okay, that's fine. You have a little under five. May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. My argument is not that the defendant waived his UMDDA rights. It's that these continuances extolled or extended or told the 180-day period. His attorney's continuances, although the trial court used the word waived, these continuances extended that 180-day period, much like in the Guest case. I also want to point out that I don't believe that August 29, 2005 motion was sufficient to comply with the UMDDA. The title of the motion was misleading. It was one of many claims raised in that motion. It wasn't delivered to the superintendent of the prison. And also, he was represented by counsel at this point. And I think...
And all of which, if we adopted that argument, suggests that it would have been effective as of November 10th.
I think that's the earliest it can possibly be effective, because that's when the trial court and the prosecution had notice of it.
He still wasn't tried within 180 days of November 10th.
Correct, Your Honor, but after that time point, his attorney asked for continuances, which the trial court found were necessary to preserve his right to the effective assistance of counsel.
Let's look at the second continuance. Why was that necessary to preserve effective assistance of counsel?
The June continuance?
The June continuance.
At the June continuance, defense counsel said he needed to get off the case. ADC wanted to reduce his caseload. But he also said, even if you require me to stay on this case, I will not be ready to go to trial. I think the trial date at that point was July 31st. I will need a continuance.
So he would have needed a continuance until the end of December, the same amount of continuance as a brand new lawyer would have needed?
He said he needed a continuance, and the trial court found that he needed that time. And then there was a discussion about...
Actually, the trial court allowed him to withdraw. I'm not sure the trial court said that if we kept you on, you would have or should have had another continuance.
Right. The trial court, I think at that hearing, said, well, I think we need to put this over. I'm not going to set a new trial date at this point, because counsel at that point had said ADC is already in the process of trying to find a new attorney. And the court said, well, we'll just set this over to make sure that we can clear a date with trial counsel. And the court then extended it, used the six-month extension again at that point to extend it.
Yes. Sorry, go ahead.
Ms. Van Horn, under the speedy trial, counsel simply asking for a continuance and having that granted is enough to toll. But under the UMDDA, aren't the provisions a little stricter? Isn't good cause required?
Yes, and I think in this case, the trial court did find good cause by assuming, given the complex nature of this case, which involved a COCA charge and numerous counts, that an attorney would need sufficient time in order to prepare for the case.
Why should the lawyers having to get off the case to service other clients penalize the defendant in the exercise of his rights?
There's nothing in the case law or in the statute or in the UMDDA statute itself that says that this has to be the defendant's fault, as in the defendant has to cause this to happen. There are cases that recognize when an attorney becomes ill, when there is a case in here when an attorney killed himself, things that aren't the defendant's fault.
Let's go back again. It's not the defendant's fault, but why should it be good cause that a lawyer has to say a year after starting to represent Mr. Roberts, gee, other clients need me, so I have to get off the case. Why should that be counted against Mr. Roberts?
Because we go by, those kinds of things are chargeable to defendant. There are plenty of cases that say we charge those continuances because his right to counsel trumps. And he did not want to represent himself in this case.
This is true, but isn't this a little bit more than just a scheduling conflict? This isn't where the lawyer gets up and says, gee, I've got a trial next month. I can't do it at the end of July. You'll have to continue it. The lawyer says, somebody else needs me. I've got to get out of this case. Go get a new lawyer and start from scratch.
Well, that's all we know from the record is the lawyer said ADC is reducing my caseload. That's all we know from this record is what that would.
Why was it necessary to replace him then? Why was it necessary to replace him? Why couldn't the court have said, no, I don't think, in as long as this case has gone, I don't think you should be allowed to withdraw. Reduce your caseload somewhere else.
Well, and he also said at the same time he was not going to be ready to go to trial either, even if he was forced to stay on this case. So that's what the trial court's looking, the lawyer saying, I'm supposed to reduce my caseload and I'm not prepared to go to trial. I won't be ready. I think there were some changes in people had been entered pleas and that kind of thing, and it become more complex than he had anticipated at that point.
Whose burden is it in this instance to have the record reflect that substitution of counsel or continuance was necessary?
Well, if you look at the UMDDA statute, it just said the court, upon a finding of good cause, may grant additional time. And I suspect from reading this record, it was one of these things that was perhaps discussed off the record, that everybody was aware of exactly what's going on. But all the record we have is everybody knew this was going to happen.
Okay, I guess for our purposes of reviewing the record, what I'm asking is, if it's necessary, as Judge Daly was asking, to show that this new counsel, that the older counsel could have been prepared perhaps within the UMDDA trial limits, but new counsel had to extend beyond, that's not really reflected in the record, how long old counsel would have needed to prepare. But I'm asking, who has the burden of making the record show that in this instance?
The UMDDA statute does not specify who has the burden of making that record.
Does the case law?
The case law and other circumstances, in some circumstances, say the prosecution has the burden of making the record. But the UMDDA is a little different because
doesn't the case law say the court and the prosecution
right,
have the burden?
Prosecution, right. The UMDDA is slightly different because it contemplates that the court can just make a finding of good cause and doesn't discuss exactly the burden of making the record.
So, to what kind of review should we give it? The trial court finds good cause. You know, what kind of standards are we to use to determine whether it was good cause? Was it necessary to preserve his right to effective assistance of counsel? Well, is it necessary when one of the options the court may say is no, stay in the case, represent him?
And perhaps pick a different trial date because counsel was at that point saying he would not be ready to go to trial at the trial date that was set at that point, which was July 31st. And I think he said, he just said, even if he were to stay, these are just my notes, even if he were to stay on the case, he would not be able to go to trial by July 31st. And I believe he gave additional reasons on the record that day, but I'm not positive. I know at some point he was discussing everything that was going on with the case and why he didn't think he could give effective assistance if he were forced to go to trial on July 31st. But to go back, I do think part of the problem here is they're discussing both General Speedy and UMDDA at the same time. And so I think sometimes they were applying one principle and another, and there is overlap there. So, and it was the prosecution's position all along that he had never validly asserted his UMDDA rights. So does the court have any more questions about this issue? Would you like me to address the second issue, the critical stage Rule 5 advisement issue?
The time is yours to use as you wish. You have about 6 minutes left.
Okay.
And the main reason why I'm bringing this up now is in the reply brief, defense counsel asserted that I had misquoted or miscited Rothbury, and it does not, and she said that it says that a Rule 5 advisement or a similar advisement is a critical stage in the proceedings. That case does not hold that. That case holds that the right to counsel attaches at similar proceedings, and therefore states are obligated to appoint counsel to any critical stages post-attachment. So it does not say that a Rule 5 advisement or something similar to that is automatically a critical stage of the proceedings, and I just wanted to point that out. If this court has no further questions, I'd ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, I agree that the Scales case does say in certain circumstances a reasonable delay may be required to protect the defendant's fundamental constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel. However, in this case, no findings were made by the court, district court, and no record was made by the DA that in this case that a delay from June to November was required to protect Mr. Roberts' constitutional right to counsel without making findings that even if Mr. Hedin was forced to stay on the case, he couldn't have gone to trial before September, or that Mr. Silver needed an extension of time beyond the speedy trial date in September.
Well, counsel, didn't he in November of 2006 at the November 16th hearing, didn't the court say, gee, in looking at everything, it looks to us that all the extensions that you've gotten have all been based on the needs of your counsel? And at one point, didn't he at least reference the complexity of the case?
No one's denying that this case is complex. It's that no record was, that record was not made before Mr. Hedin withdrew in June.
Did the court make that finding or reference the complexity of the case in the November 16, 2006 hearing?
Yes, and this case is complex. And, however,
and excuse me, counsel, back in June 9th, you know, did not defense counsel also say, gee, if I were to stay on the case because of the new witnesses that had been introduced into the case, I wouldn't be able to be ready by July 31st.
That's correct. However, even if that's true, that doesn't mean that the government gets an extension now till November of 2006 when no record was made in June, that Mr. Hedin couldn't have tried the case even with the new witnesses prior to the speedy trial UMDDA deadline in September, or that Mr. Silver would have needed that kind of extension. Any findings by the district court at that pretrial readiness conference in November that all these extensions were due or required because of the needs of counsel were an after-the-fact rationalization, not based on the actual record being made at these hearings, because no record was being made at these hearings. The Marquez case, 613 P. 2nd 1302, puts the burden on the prosecution to make that record, and the prosecution never made that record. Instead, the prosecution kept insisting that this is not a UMDDA case because he never received notice of the UMDDA, when that's clearly not true. He clearly received the defendant's pro se motion because he filed a written response to it.
In April of 2006, almost a year after it had been filed and after they had talked about it in November of 2005.
Right. So it's clear that he received it at... It's clear that the district court received it when the defendant mailed it, because that copy is date stamped. We don't know when the DA got it, but the DA had, if the DA thought that he was missing something from the file, he had the burden to go look at it. I think that the DA probably didn't read the pro se pleadings, and that's why he claims to not be on notice of it. Before I run out of time, I just do want to give a brief rebuttal to the Attorney General about the critical stage of the proceeding argument. What's different about this case is that July 2005 was not your normal Rule 5 first advisement, because it involved the same charges that were already pending in another case for which he already had counsel appointed. Therefore, that was a critical stage of the proceeding. That is completely different than a situation where a defendant's being brought in on a Rule 5 advisement for the very first time in a case. That's not what happened here. There's this overlap of the two cases with nine of the charges. And also, I'd like to point out, because of the jurisdictional difference between the UMDDA and the speedy trial, even if November 10th, 2005 is the first time that everybody was put on notice of the UMDDA, there still was no trial within 100 days after that. And there was no actual waiver by the defendant to waive beyond 180 days. There was just all of this argument that he acquiesced due to trial counsel accepting trial dates beyond 180 days. And there was no record made that those extension of times was necessary because trial counsel needed the additional time. That was always just assumed and not put on the record. Yeah.
Counsel, I see you're out of time. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.